So we ended up with a young solicitor from the local criminal law specialist. The solicitor was white, presentable, and spoke with an affected South London accent that didn't fool anyone, except maybe Phoebe. After caution plus two, we could have gone straight to the business with the drugs, but our priority, as determined by the senior officers, even now monitoring us from the video suite, was to find out what the fuck the Americans had wanted. Phoebe said she had no idea. "I was downstairs by the pool," she said, "and they just appeared." They, being Crewcut, who finally identified himself as Dean, and his merry men. They'd asked about her eBay activities. "What about your eBay activities?" I asked.
"I don't know," she said. "I never use eBay."
"Do you have a PayPal account?" asked Galeed.
"No, I have a credit card," said Phoebe,
who was perfectly happy to buy online and perfectly happy to buy second-hand, just not at the same time.
"It's so much more fun getting clothes from charity shops," she said. "I once almost grabbed a genuine Nicole Fiery jacket in a charity shop in Chelsea, but this woman beat me to it."
She wasn't sure what she was supposed to have done on eBay, but Dean, formerly known as Crewcut, seemed to think she'd tried to sell a book. We asked what kind of book.
"An old book," she said. "Really old, like centuries old. A ledger, that's what Boss American called it."
"Did he mention the title?" I asked. Phoebe said not, but when we pressed, she thought that Dean might have referred to it as the Last Ledger. This all seemed a bit pat to me. Suspects often can't resist dropping in little bits of detail in the hope that it adds veracity to their statement, when all it actually does is make us more suspicious. I made a note to pursue this question in a later interview, and we retraced the timeline leading up to the American's arrival.
"I was in the kitchen, getting a drink, and..." Phoebe frowned. "Then I went downstairs. Somebody knocked on the door."
She didn't know the exact time, but it wasn't that long before the cleaner left. We'd had the door under observation by then, and definitely hadn't seen anyone. Nobody sneaks past Galeed. She says it's a talent you acquire if you're the eldest child in a big family.
"Was the knock at the front door?"
asked Galeed.
"Must have been," said Phoebe,
but she didn't seem so sure.
"Did you answer it?"
asked Galeed.
"No,"
said Phoebe. "Was it a knock or the doorbell?" I asked.
"It was a knock," she said hesitantly, and then, with more confidence, "definitely a knock."
So it could have been the back door and not the front. Perhaps that's how Dean and co. planned to make their escape.
"What did you do next?"
asked Galeed.
"I went downstairs," said Phoebe. "Did you go for a swim?"
asked Galeed.
"I must have done," said Phoebe. "Why else would I go down there?"
She looked bone dry to me when I'd seen her.
"What were you wearing when you were in the kitchen?"
asked Galeed.
"Is that important?" "Helps us establish a timeline," said Galeed.
"Jeans," said Phoebe,
"or maybe tracksuit bottoms and a sweatshirt."
"Not your bikini?"
"No,"
said Phoebe.
"Not under your other clothes?"
asked Galeed. Phoebe looked at me and rolled her eyes at Galeed.
"No,"
she said. "Do you keep it downstairs by the pool?" I asked.
"Don't be silly," said Phoebe. "It's a Sophia by Vicks. Ollie bought it for me and niece. I wouldn't leave it downstairs where she could get her hands on it."
She being Victoria Jones, Phoebe's stepmother.
"So you must have gone upstairs to your room before you went down to the pool," I said.
Phoebe shrugged.
"Yeah," she said. "Must have."
Memory is unreliable, and it isn't unusual for a witness to forget big chunks of the events that led to them answering your questions, even when things were fresh. Still, the obvious hole in Phoebe's timeline was beginning to worry me.
"Before the Americans turned up," I said, "was anyone in the basement with you?"
"Like who?"
"Like anybody."
Phoebe frowned.
"I was talking to someone," she said.
"Do you remember who?" asked Galeed.
"Someone from school, I think," she said.
"A school friend?" asked Galeed.
"No,"
said Phoebe and bit her lip.
"An old person. Man or woman?"
"Man." "A teacher?" I asked.
"No," said Phoebe firmly. "Not a teacher. You know, it's funny, but I think it was a parent," she said.
"What makes you think that?" asked Galeed.
"He was familiar, like I totally knew him from somewhere, but definitely not a teacher."
"But yet you didn't recognize him," I said.
"I did, but Not so I could tell you who he was.
She made a waving motion with both hands.
It's like when you're halfway to school and you can't remember what you had for breakfast. You know, you had breakfast. You know what you usually have for breakfast, but you cannot for the life of you remember what you actually had today.
Doing a two-hander during an interview is all about rhythm. You and your partner shift backwards and forwards to keep the interviewee ever so slightly off balance. If they don't have time to think about their answers, then they're more likely to blurt out the truth, or at least contradict themselves enough for you to figure out what they're lying about. Good cop, bad cop is the Hollywood version, simplified and sexed up for maximum drama in minimum screen time. Me and Ghalid had spent a year, off and on, interviewing everyone from mad mechanics to surly bouncers. Not to mention the thing with the police horse, which I've promised never to bring up on pain of ninjutsu. So she knew that the next line was mine, which would have probably been me asking what his voice sounded like. But my mind, ironically, went blank, because all at once I knew who had been in the basement swimming pool with us that evening. "What did his voice sound like?" asked Ghalid. If Phoebe answered, I wasn't listening, because I was thinking that the subset of St. Paul's parents that Phoebe knew personally was going to be finite, maybe as low as 10 to 20 males, and they'd all be on a list at the school. And that list could be cross-referenced with the list of little crocodiles and whittled down by finding out who had a reliable alibi for certain important dates. He'd been good at covering his tracks. But like Nightingale had said, he's not Moriarty. He's just another criminal. And sooner or later, he's going to make a mistake. And I was fairly certain that the faceless man had just made it.
Chapter 9. The Tiger Hunting Committee. The main purpose of an administrative meeting is to establish collective guilt for whatever fuck-up arises out of its decisions. That way, when the wheels come off, you can't pretend you didn't know what was happening because you were there, weren't you, when those decisions were made. And we've got the minutes to prove it. In the normal course of events, a lowly PC like me, if they're sensible, finds themselves something better to do. Paperwork, house-to-house inquiries, searching a landfill, anything. Unfortunately, the Follies flat management structure, viz., there being only two of us, and its specialist nature, meant that not only was I at the meeting, but I was expected to make a valuable contribution. So here we were, in a sparsely furnished meeting room on the 14th floor of the Empress State Building at Olympia, with representatives from the DPS, Belgravia MIT, and the National Crime Agency, all chaired by one Deputy Assistant Commissioner Richard Folsom, who apart from being a wholly owned subsidiary of the Tyburn Preservation Society, had it in for me personally on account of that business at Covent Garden. "Ask not for whom the buck stops," I thought. "It stops for thee." I noticed that Ghalid had made herself scarce. Folsom glanced at me, the tick over his right eye causing a twitch, before turning to Sewall and asking him to bring us all up to speed on the current state of the investigation and our operational posture, which could be summarized as confused and ready to spring into action, just as soon as we had the faintest idea where to spring. We held Phoebe Beaumont-Jones on Friday night because Bromley Crime Squad wanted a word about the MDMA. But since they couldn't lay their hands on Aidan Burley, the guy who allegedly sold her the gear, she walked out of the nick on Saturday afternoon without a charge. DAC Folsom, to nobody's surprise, suggested that since there was no indication that Christina Chorley had been coerced into taking the pills, and that Olivia Thames McAllister had retracted her statement, not to mention the complete lack of corroboration that she or her friend Phoebe had been involved, it was probably best to close down Operation Marigold and pass the file to the CPS, especially given the number of other pressing concerns that have come to light, said Folsom. For a second, I thought Sewell was going to fight it just on general principles, but then he shrugged. You don't get to DCI without knowing a losing proposition when you see one, and Folsom's right. There were more important things to worry about.
La majesté, égalité de loi, qui interdit aux riches comme aux pauvres de coucher sur les ponts, de mendier dans la rue et de voler du pain.
Said Nightingale later, when we were preparing our case notes, which is French for them that has gets. So goodbye, Operation Marigold, which left Operation Cart Horse, the hunt for Leslie May, Operation Wentworth, which was the fraud investigation surrounding the illegal demolition of Sky Garden Tower, and Operation Tinker, which was the still-open murder inquiry into the unpleasant death of Patrick Mulkern. Bromley MIT, which owned Tinker, was notably absent from the meeting, having dumped their files on us on Sunday afternoon and scarpered. The SIO had given up her Sunday just to get them off her hands. And then there were the Americans. It took the fire brigade a day and a half to secure the remains of the house, enough to recover Krukut's body, which was described by Dr. Jennifer Vaughan as suffering from crush trauma, and by Dr. Walid as mostly flat. Fortunately, no other bodies were recovered, and the neighboring houses, while damaged, were declared safe. The neighbors themselves were spooked in a way that only watching £3 million worth of equity sink into a hole in the ground can do. And it was only a matter of time before they tried to blame us for it. Even as we met at the Empress State Building, a crack team of police lawyers were figuring out how to blame it on the contractor who'd built the basement. Krukut's compadres refused to talk when interviewed, and even refused the routine offer to contact the American embassy. None of them had been carrying ID, and those who joined me in the 20-meter underwater dash hadn't been carrying weapons when they were fished out. I was pretty confident that when the weapons were recovered, they would be the same scrubbed and anonymous Glocks that Teddy and the driver had been caught with. "Have we contacted the American embassy ourselves?" asked Folsom. The woman from the National Crime Agency said they'd asked Belgravia not to do that just yet. "We want to know if anyone official already knows they're here," she said. I wondered if it was safe to contact Agent Reynolds, but I didn't want to drop her in the shit unless I had to. Folsom went back over my actions in the basement.
"Why didn't you wait for backup?" he asked.
"I had reason to believe a Falcon incident was underway, and that a member of the public was at risk," I said. "I believed that a careful approach would help calm the situation until the appropriate Falcon resources could be deployed." Folsom asked what appropriate Falcon resources might be when they're at home.
"I rather think that would be me," said Nightingale, and Peter cleared the action with me before proceeding. "It was the right thing to do, and I believe that had the external factors not intervened, then a peaceful resolution could have been effectuated."
Folsom nodded, as if squirreling away the word effectuated for use at future meetings. Then he gave me a thin-lipped smile.
"This is not the first time Peter here has been put into a position of potential harm because of a shortfall in Falcon-capable resources," he said, and made a show of consulting a list. "These incidents include a severe RTI involving an ambulance, a near drowning in the Thames, a confrontation with armed men in a sewer, being buried under rubble at Oxford Street Station, and, if this report is to be believed, surviving a fall from a 30-story block of flats while it was in the process of explosive demolition." I opened my mouth to say it was more complicated than that, but he held up a hand to silence me. "He was involved in an unauthorized hostage exchange in Herefordshire, an armed standoff in Essex, and let's not forget the business at the Royal Botanical Gardens in Kew," which was totally not my fault, I might add. Although I probably shouldn't have used the word crinoid in my official report. "Then this week alone, there have been 2 confrontations with armed men, the second one culminating in yet another building collapse and fatality." I noticed he hadn't mentioned his own glorious contribution to the Bow Street riots. "All these incidents," said Folsom, turning back to Nightingale, "were exacerbated by the current operational bottleneck caused by a lack of suitable Falcon-capable resources."
"It takes time to train new apprentices," said Nightingale. "It's not a process that can be rushed."
"So you agree that there is a shortfall in appropriate resources?" asked Folsom, who was obviously looking to get an admission from Nightingale that the folly wasn't up to the job, and one that was nicely minuted at an official meeting. "If I can speak to that, sir," I said,
the Special Assessment Unit has recently instituted a program of capacity expansion in order to build greater operational robustness and provide a more efficient service to our partner OCUs when dealing with both Falcon and pseudo-Falcon incidents, the first phase of which is already underway.
I noticed that Stephanopoulos was hiding her mouth with her hand. Folsom, who should have known better, took the bait. The first phase being, he asked,
strengthening our specialist support, particularly in the forensic and medical area, with a view to providing a continuous on-call service to investigation teams that might need them, coupled with the development of a best practice guide for use in dealing with suspected Falcon-related incidents and investigations, I said,
and heard Seawall smother a cough, at least. I assume it was a cough.
In tandem with this Phase 1 implementation, the SAU is also developing a consultation document that will be sent out to all priority Falcon stakeholders prior to being submitted to the Commissioner's Office for approval.
Why was Phase 1 implemented without a consultation paper? Asked Folsom, or in other words, how did you manage to spend money without clearing it with the Commissioner first?
Phase 1 was implemented under existing Home Office guidelines, I said.
Last updated in 1956, during the Suez Crisis, no less.
Which must have been a good week to announce bits of political housekeeping you might not want to attract too much attention. In addition, Phase 1 was financed entirely from within the current SAU budget.
In other words, we have our own money, so you can stick your oversight in your La Traviata and smoke it.
Folsom hesitated and then shrugged. He wasn't happy, but he was playing a long game. Besides, he was right. The current Folly operational structure was archaic and not fit for purpose. It was just that I didn't trust him or Lady Ty to fix it. Of course, now I was going to have to deliver a consultation paper pretty damn sharpish, or I was going to be in major trouble. So we moved on to what seemed like 5 days, but was actually just a couple of hours of wrangling about who was going to do what, which in the end boiled down to deciding that the NCA would carry on investigating the faceless man's shadowy commercial empire, CTC would handle the Americans, and the Folly would handle Falcon-related stuff with support from Belgravia MIT.
It's a good thing that was sorted out, said Seawall. I was beginning to worry.
We were still running short-handed because Belgravia was busy mopping up their stabbing. But at least we had Galeed, who was, I felt, going to be thrilled to bits. Before we could escape the building, a DS Kittredge from CTC took me and Nightingale aside and said that there were some people we needed to talk to first. Kittredge had had the misfortune of getting tangled up with a Folly case a couple of years previously, and had obviously got himself on a list as a result. No doubt a senior officer had told him that, since he'd dealt with us weirdos before, he was perfectly placed to do it again. His expression was bland, but I could tell he'd much rather be out arresting medical students in Ladbroke Grove. He took us up to the 29th floor of ESB, which, along with the 28th, was the domain of CTC, Counterterrorism Command, which is the long spoon by which the Met deals with political crime and the security services. There, in a conference room, Kittredge introduced us to a couple of officers from MI5. The spooks were a man and a woman, both white, both with deliberately suppressed posh accents and carefully nondescript off-the-peg suits. He was in his 30s, rugby player fit, with pale blue eyes and a tendency to squint. She was a bit older, with auburn hair in a neat bob, grey eyes, and gave her name as Fanula, no surname. Blondie didn't give his name at all, and spent most of the meeting squinting at Nightingale. One of them had brought along a fully rugged tough book, presumably so they could play Angry Birds under battlefield conditions. Fanula saw me looking and gave a rueful shake of the head. Don't ask, she said.
Does it self-destruct? I asked.
The blondie gave me an irritated look, but DC Kittredge's lips twitched. No, said Fanula, but in a pinch you can beat someone to death with it.
I'd like to know how you disabled their vehicle, said Blondie.
I could show you, I said, if you don't mind me demonstrating on your laptop. Fanula put her hand on top of the case
an unconscious protective movement, and I thought, you totally know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I believe the purpose of this meeting, said Nightingale, is to pool information regarding our American friends.
What with all the new Islamist franchises springing up, said Fionnuala. Not to mention the hardy perennials on the far right and the unrepentant Fenians, we're a little bit too stretched to spare much attention for our closest allies.
Do you know who they are?
Asked Nightingale. We do now, said Fionnuala. They're a PMC based outside of Charlottesville, Virginia. They've done a few small-scale contracts in Afghanistan and Iraq, which is how we know them, but nothing like as active as Blackwater. Their official name is Alderman Technical Solutions, but that was registered in 2005. Before that, it gets murky, but we think they were probably known as the Virginia Gentleman's Company. Nightingale stirred.
That name is familiar, he said. I believe I met them during the war.
According to Nightingale, they'd formed the second wave of American practitioners who'd joined the war effort following Pearl Harbor. The first wave had consisted of 100 or so volunteers from the University of Pennsylvania, the so-called printer's men, who'd arrived in 1940 and worked directly with the Folly or in conjunction with Special Operations Executive. The Virginia gentlemen, inevitably nicknamed the Virgins, had kept themselves separate from the British and Commonwealth practitioners.
They mostly operated out of Istanbul, said Nightingale. I got the impression that they had rather a low opinion of us. And, of course, there was that little matter of our allying with Tecumseh in 1812.
Blondie perked up and asked for clarification. Apparently, back in 1812, when the special relationship was special in a whole different way, British policy had been to support the creation of a Native American Confederacy as a buffer between an aggressively expansionist United States and the completely peace-loving and not in any way land-grabbing bit of the British Empire, soon to be known as Canada. When the Treaty of Ghent ended the War of 1812, the British, in time-honored fashion, abandoned their allies, who were subsequently wiped out by the Americans, along with any other tribe that happened to be in the same general vicinity, even those that had actually been allied with the US government during the war. It's exactly this sort of thing, of course, which gives colonialism a bad name. Nightingale had gained the impression that the Virgins had never forgiven the Folly for its role in providing Tecumseh's medicine men with modern Newtonian techniques.
They rather avoided having anything to do with us, said Nightingale.
Were they involved in the attack on Ettersburg? Asked Fionnuala.
No, said Nightingale. They were...
He paused, looking for the right word.
Contemptuous. They didn't believe the research the Germans were doing represented a significant threat to their Allied cause. I thought they were wrong about the threat, but right about the dangers of launching a major operation so deep in enemy territory.
Dangers that were realized when the cream of British wizardry was cut down in the forests of Grosser Ettersburg.
Of course, we didn't know about the Manhattan Project at the time, said Nightingale. Although I rather suspect they did.
There was a definite note of bitterness there. Personally, I thought it was probably better that parts of southern Germany didn't glow in the dark, but then I didn't leave most of my friends in that forest. Nightingale shook his head and gave the spooks a tight smile.
Of course, none of this is relevant to the present case, he said.
Did you know the Americans were on their way?
I was given the heads up last week, I said.
This would be the phone call from Agent Kimberly Reynolds of the FBI, said Fionnuala. Yes?
I said it was, and they asked if I'd been in contact with her since. No, I said. I didn't want to land her in it.
So you don't know she boarded an American Airlines flight from New York last night, said Fionnuala. That can hardly be a coincidence now, can it?
We agreed that it probably wasn't, but it also wasn't anything I'd done.
Tell me, officer, said Nightingale. Which worries you the most? The idea that we have our own channels of communication with the Americans, or that we don't?
What worries us, said Fionnuala, putting the emphasis on the plural, is that as the agency charged with the defense of the realm, we are only hearing about this now.
We didn't feel it was required, said Nightingale.
We rather thought you had your hands full, what with the Irish Republicans and the like. There was a clear agreement in 1948 that magic and the demimonde would remain our responsibility.
That was half a century ago, said Fionnuala. In those days we didn't officially exist, and we took a man's word that he was playing a straight bat. Now we run recruitment ads in The Guardian and have a mission statement and everything. Things have moved on a bit. The world has changed and we with it. You have not.
She glanced at me.
Or at least not noticeably. We cannot ignore the potential damage that could be inflicted by an individual armed with your suite of capabilities.
I squirreled away that last phrase for my upcoming briefing document.
Especially, said Fionnuala, when we don't have an effective counter.
Shoot them in the head with a rifle, said Nightingale, or a pistol from close range if the practitioner is not on guard.
Would that work on you? Asked Fionnuala.
It has worked on me, said Nightingale. Twice. You see, you can train an irregular in a couple of weeks, and you can learn how to make a bomb by reading a book, but it takes years to become even somewhat useful in a fight using magic.
He nodded in my direction.
Unless you're a particularly gifted student, and even then.
He shrugged.
And its use in interrogation is limited, I said, because training someone to resist the glamour is easy.
All of this is beside the point,
said Nightingale.
We shall, of course, include you in the latest round of consultation papers, given that you are...
He looked to me for help.
Stakeholders, I said,
and he gave me the ghost of a wink. But unless you have anything useful to tell us, then I'm afraid you'll have to excuse us,
said Nightingale. And stood. I dutifully followed him up. They didn't have anything useful to say after that, so we took ourselves off.
Another feint by Tyburn, do you think?
Asked Nightingale as we drove back to Belgravia. No, I said. We're just out in the open these days. I'm amazed the media haven't jumped on us yet.
I'd expected Tyburn to at least think about using the media as leverage in her long-running campaign to reform the folly. I had to assume she was being blocked by her sister Fleet, or possibly even by her mother. Beverly had wanted to know if the whole collapsing house thing had been down to Tyburn. She'd asked about it as we shared a bath on Sunday morning, her version of tea and sympathy.
Don't you know?
I asked.
She's your sister.
The Tyburn ran right behind Phoebe Beaumont Jones's house, in the direction that the first burst of water had come from. And we were still waiting for the Thames Water engineering report as to where the flood had originated. I said I didn't think she was that angry with me.
Maybe not with you,
said Beverly, and walked her toes up my chest.
But she's been backing up pipes from Westminster to Hampstead since you arrested baby Ollie. Lesbians she can cope with, drug dealers she can cope with. Ollie grassing herself up to cover for her girlfriend? That had to piss her off big time.
Seriously? I asked.
Well, if it was her, then she definitely wasn't after you.
I asked how she knew.
You're still breathing, she said.
I didn't think it was Lady Ty either, even though she'd joined her daughter as a person of interest in the house collapse, with her very own nominal node in Holmes, and a set of actions aimed at eliminating her from the inquiry. I figured that Phoebe Beaumont Jones had been talking to the faceless man when they'd been interrupted by crew cut and his American virgins, and then by me and my unfailing ability to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. The flood was just to cover his escape, or I doubt that any of us would still be walking about. He might have hoped that Lady Ty would get the blame, although why he might have thought that was a bit of a mystery. Maybe he knew something we didn't, or perhaps he was getting bad advice? And if Phoebe was right, that the faceless man was a parent of a student at St. Paul's, even better, a parent she'd met personally, then the haystack he was hiding in was finally shrunk down to a manageable size. Once we were at Belgravia, we measured up our haystack and looked for shortcuts. Ghulid was back at St. Paul's to gather up the names of the parents or guardians of all the students. Stephanopoulos went with her to provide some senior rankage, in case they faced any upper-class fuckery. While they did that,
I drilled down into the reams of stuff we had on the parents of the kids who'd attended the unfortunate MDMA and brain damage party. I considered disregarding the mothers, but it occurred to me that we didn't know for certain that the faceless man was male. I also started going back over all the cases with suspected links to the faceless man to see if any of their faces fit, so to speak. A year ago, Richard Lewis, a planning officer with Southwark Borough Council, had thrown himself in front of a tube train at Paddington Station. We'd always suspected that he'd jumped under the influence of a glamour and had pinpointed the moment we thought the glamour had gone in. Since it occurred just short of the ticket barrier in a London Underground station, it happened in one of the most CCTV-saturated places in the world, and since glamour was not something you did from a distance, the faceless man must have been caught on camera, along with about 1,000 other people. So I reckoned it was worth a punt, and I spent some time with pictures of the parents, seeing if I could match any of them to faces in the crowd. And because magical facial recognition systems have yet to be invented, it had taken me most of the weekend, except for the bits I spent at Bev's, and the 2 hours magic practice that Nightingale insisted on.
"We need to work on your precision," he'd said.
I didn't spot anyone on the CCTV, but I did catalogue most of the likely targets to make it easier for whatever poor sod got lumbered with the job of checking them against the parents of the entire school. "Plus staff," said Gulid. "Phoebe might have confused the two. Children often do." The search was going to stay a low priority because we had a key time frame, the collapse of the house on Friday evening, to check alibis against. Phoebe Beaumont Jones's dad's alibi being that he wasn't in the country at the time, although it turned out he had gone to Magdalen College, Oxford, in the early 90s. Roughly the same time as the known little crocodile Richard Lewis, who threw himself under a tube train, and Christina Chorley's father Martin had been there too. It would have been nice if just one of them had gone to Cambridge, or, God forbid, Bristol, which is where, according to Gulid, posh students went when they failed to get into Oxbridge. There was always the cheerful thought that the faceless man, in proper Sith Lord fashion, had trained up someone as his apprentice. But I didn't think that was likely. If he'd had a fully trained apprentice, he wouldn't have needed Varvara. And if they weren't trained, then I could probably take them. But if that apprentice was Leslie May? Which one of us would hesitate the longest, I wondered. Normally when you TIE a nominal, you send the lowest-ranking member of the team round to flat-out ask the subject to account for their whereabouts. Then, usually, the same lowly minion does all the cross-referencing with CCTV, mobile phone records, and or actual living, breathing witnesses to verify the alibi. We couldn't do that with the faceless man, because we couldn't predict what he might do if he was tipped off. Since his capability envelope stretched from levelling a house to causing luckless members of the public to throw themselves off tall buildings, it was, as Nightingale said, like hunting big game. We needed to stay downwind and undetected until we lined up our elephant gun. Since the elephant gun in question was Nightingale, this meant I had to wait until he was free before we could beard any suspects in their lairs. We started with Albert Price. And because there was an off chance that Nightingale's mere presence might spook our quarry, he would remain hidden nearby, ready to rush in and put the boot in. My role in that scenario was to race for the exit as fast as possible, taking any potential collateral with me. Unless Leslie was there, in which case I was supposed to grab her. As it was, when we tooled up outside Albert Price's six-bedroom semi in St. John's Wood, he wasn't even there, which was a bit of an intelligence failure. Fortunately, Albertina answered the door, and without prompting, invited me in. I left Nightingale in the Jag, contemplating the infinite, doing the crossword in the Telegraph, and keeping an ear out for screams. The house was early Victorian enough to retain some Regency class. Inside, it still looked like a place where people actually lived, with framed prints on the walls and bookshelves and furniture that had its corners smoothed off with use. There were signs that money had taken hold in the kitchen, though, sprouting handless, brushed steel cabinets, randomly deformed sink units, and work surfaces as cheerfully domestic as a pathology lab.
Albertina was doing her best to humanize it by spreading empty cups, jars with the tops off and knives sticking out, a dealer's shuffle of brown bread spilling out of its packet, and a recyclable plastic bottle of guaranteed organic semi-skimmed milk thoughtfully left in a patch of sunlight. "He's gone to Aberystwyth to see Grandma," said Albertina, and offered me a Marmite sandwich. "She's not very happy with Dad at the moment." I wanted to ask where her dad had been on Friday evening, on the off chance he'd been dropping a house on me at the time, but I couldn't think of a way of slipping it into the conversation. Instead, I asked why Albertina's grandma wasn't happy with him. "She doesn't like the idea of him moving to America," said Albertina. "She says that she's only just got used to him living in London."
"When did he move to London?" I asked.
"Forever ago," said Albertina. Actually, according to my notes, it had been just after he graduated in 1972. But when you're 17, forever isn't a very long time at all.
"Aberystwyth is miles," I said. "It's a bit of a drive, isn't it? Or did he take the train?"
"Dad doesn't take the train anymore," said Albertina. "He says he's allergic to other people. He drives up, takes him ages."
"So when did he set out for Wales then?"
"Friday morning," she said, "to avoid the traffic." She said it so smoothly I wondered if she'd been coached. But to what end?
Still, some poor sod back at Belgravia was going to be spending some time with the AMPR logs to see whether Albert Price's Mercedes M-Class had been spotted on the M4, and if so, what time? I hoped it wasn't going to be me.
"When are you moving to the States?"
I said, wondering whether we were going to have to ask them politely to stay in the country, and what earthly pretext we were going to justify it with.
"Not until the spring," said Albertina, "and I'm not going with. This is totally just for him, the intern, and the replacements."
The intern, being the woman featured in her father's acclaimed semi-autobiographical novel, wife number 3, and mother of the 2 replacements. Even now, hopefully, vomiting all over the back seat of her mother's Toyota as she ferried them from playgroup to cafe clatch to ballet for tiny tots.
"She's the one that's desperate to move back to the States," said Albertina,
and had persuaded her husband that he'd be treated with the respect he deserved there, not like in London where no one fully appreciated his genius.
"Dad's always been a bit insecure about that," said Albertina. "He won the Booker Prize," I said,
and had pretty much made the shortlist every year he had a new book out. Albertina shrugged.
"He's haunted by a deep, dark secret," she said.
"Yeah?" I said, trying not to sound overly interested.
"Yeah,"
she said, then asked if I liked sci-fi. I suggested that I was occasionally partial to a bit of SF, you know, when the mood took me.
"Then you'll love this," she said,
and took me to see her dad's study. If the kitchen had been colonized by money, then the study had been irretrievably lost to literature a long time ago. Every spare centimeter of the wall space had been covered with shelves, all of which were stuffed with books. It reminded me of my dad's record collection, which filled up my parents' bedroom and pushed every other activity, except sleeping, out into the rest of their small flat. Which was why my old bedroom was now my mum's walk-in wardrobe and shoe store. But unlike my dad's precious vinyl, which had to be stored vertical and absolutely upright in exactly the right size shelves, here, books spilled out onto the floor and across the big hardwood dining room table in the middle of the room that substituted for a desk. Albert Price wasn't averse to using his books as coffee coasters, or to weigh down piles of hard copy, or even as an impromptu building material for shelves, where they served to support even more books, an old-fashioned boombox, and a row of withered potted plants.
"Have you spotted them yet?"
asked Albertina. Since I was looking for signs that her dad was an ethically challenged practitioner, I doubted I was looking for whatever she was talking about, and I was just about to say no when I did spot them. Most of the shelving had enough horizontal space to take quite tall books, but one unit had clearly been custom-built to take small, old-fashioned paperbacks. The spines were colourful, smooth, and uncracked. I knew the signs. This was a collection, not a library. I looked at Albertina, who grinned back and said that it was okay for me to touch them.
"The intern is totally desperate to leave these behind," she said.
She had someone in to value them on the sly.
I pulled out a book at random. It had a solid yellow spine and a DAW logo. The cover looked like a classic Frazetta or a good imitation. All muscular white men and women in implausibly tight spacesuits with bubble helmets. The title was The Crystal Spires of Mazarin by T.J. Morton. I checked the next book along and found it was the same title. This time, the New English Library edition, with a cover depicting a strange alien landscape with globular trees and improbably low-hanging planets. A random sample of the rest of the bookcase revealed multiple first paperback editions of three SF writers I'd never heard of, although I was pretty sure I'd read at least a couple of the books. The aforementioned T.J. Morton, Alan Vincent, and Carter Houston. There was a lot of Carter Houston, who apparently specialized in mighty thewed barbarians and, if the quotes on the front were to be believed, was favorably compared with Howard's Conan and John Norman's Gore. Interesting choice of authors, I said. Not authors, said Albertina. Author. They're all pen names. Not your dad, I said. It couldn't be, because some of the books dated back to the 1950s, although he could have been a teen prodigy like my father.
Close, she said. It was Grandad.
Who, according to my obviously flawed IIP report on the Price family, had led a blameless life teaching military history at Aberystwyth University. And according to Albertina, who was obviously a fan, also had a sideline as a prolific pulp SF writer until the early 70s, just about the time his son, Albert, had picked up his first literary award for his debut novel, Cunning Men. And I thought of the person who had written, in elvish script, the words, "If you can read this, you are not only a nerd, but probably dead," across the face of a demon trap. I was trying to think of a way of segueing the conversation around to asking whether her dad ever talked about magic or ghosts or anything of that ilk, when my phone rang. It was a call from Bromley Crime Squad regarding Aidan Burley.
"Have you found him yet?"
I asked. "Sort of," said Bromley. "Bits of him anyway." Chapter 10. Picking up the pieces. Everybody's a slave to their habits. Little behavioural tics that we're often barely conscious of. And even if we are, we probably couldn't change them if we wanted to. Bev always sleeps on the left side of the bed. Galeed always puts three sugars in her black Americano. And the faceless man has two ways of killing people he wants dead. If it's just business, then he favors the quiet and forensically invisible approach. An apparent suicide or a sudden heart attack. If he's pissed off or wants to make an example, then it gets very messy indeed. Having your dick bitten off or your bones set on fire from the inside are only a couple of the merry ways that we know of for certain. We'd been reluctant to employ a forensic psychologist because of the well-founded fear that they might section us for believing in fairies. But you didn't need a degree to figure out that the whole making an example aspect was actually bollocks. It was simply an excuse to do horribly inventive things to fellow human beings. You certainly had to wonder what poor Aidan Burley had done to justify having his face nailed to a tree in a small park in suburban South London. Well, not nailed exactly, removed from his skull and attached to the trunk at head height. My head height, I noticed. Not Aidan's, who had been shorter. Downham Fields was a low green mound that formed the centrepiece of Downham Estate, a 1920s housing estate in Lewisham, built by the London County Council as a low-rent version of the then-fashionable Garden City idea. It was to house the respectable working class of Bermondsey and Rotherhithe in 6,000 unremarkable semis. Unremarkable, of course, providing you'd grown up with such luxuries as indoor plumbing and back gardens. To ensure that the hoi polloi were properly appreciative of the largesse bestowed upon them, the LCC employed inspectors to enforce acceptable standards of cleanliness and order. Although this wasn't enough reassurance for the residents of a nearby private estate, who insisted on a 2-meter wall topped with broken glass to maintain a suitable degree of separation.
The low hill in the park was crowned by a Catholic church and attached school, and further down the slope was a rectangular copse of trees, which I totally failed to identify. Just inside the tree line, in a surprisingly compact area, was what was left of Aidan Burley. Bromley MIT had already done a preliminary canvas of the area, plus house-to-house and CCTV, before gleefully dumping it all on Nightingale, me and Stephanopoulos and skipping away with happy cries. They wanted nothing to do with it. I could empathize. Neither did I. According to Bromley's timeline, the murder had taken place in a 15-minute window between when a couple of school kids had walked past the trees on their way to the leisure center next to the church and a Mr. Thomas Gantry had noticed Chuck, his Irish setter, bounding towards him with what turned out not to be a stray leg of pork. Chuck really hadn't wanted to relinquish his prize and finally had to be distracted with a piece of cheese to make him let go. Dr. Jennifer Vaughan found the whole thing very educational.
I didn't even know dogs like cheese, she said, and took saliva samples from Chuck for elimination purposes.
In the 15-minute window, Aidan Burley had been dismembered at every major joint, ankle, knee, hip, shoulder, elbow, and wrist, leaving just his head and torso lying at the base of a tree. That part was still dressed in the jeans and sweatshirt he'd been wearing when I interviewed him. Later, stress analysis determined that this was because his limbs had been torn out of their sockets by an extreme axial force strong enough to rip skin and snap tendons.
Not something that's easy to do, said Dr. Waleed. Particularly with a young person, he added,
and then had a discussion with Dr. Vaughan about whether the victim's youthfully stretchy skin would have made that much difference to the level of force required. Aidan Burley's head was a nightmare, the skin of the face having been neatly removed to reveal the dried, meat-colored muscles and tendons beneath. It looked almost surgical, although later microscopic inspection revealed that the tissue had been torn rather than cut. His face had then been mounted on a tree so that it looked out over the curving rows of identical semi-detached houses that stretched away to the horizon. I sighted along the direction of his gaze, but saw nothing remarkable. It had been raining off and on, and the clouds were low, so visibility was crap. The wind kept picking at the corners of the white forensic tents that the Soccos were trying to jockey into position to cover all the bits.
I'm not sure I like the implications of this development at all, said Nightingale,
and I knew he was thinking of Leslie's new face and the medical miracle magic of the Viscountess Lyndon Limmer. This is him talking directly to us, you know, I said.
Yes, said Nightingale. That's what I don't like.
The doctors Waleed and Vaughan agreed that the faceless man might be showing off, especially when Vaughan reported that the skin of the face had been fused to the bark, and, more importantly, that the wood itself had been subtly reshaped to substitute for the bones and cartilage that normally gives the face its shape.
Otherwise, I seriously doubt you'd have recognized him so easily, she said.
It still seemed unnecessarily flashy. And why Downham Fields, when there were half a dozen open green spaces further south, much closer to Bromley and Aidan Burley's old stamping ground?
There's a chance that this may have very little to do with Mr. Burley at all, said Nightingale. At least nothing personal, per se.
Shit, I said. Because if there was something the faceless man liked better than a dismemberment, then it was creating a distraction in one place while he sneaked in and murdered whoever his real target was. I looked at Nightingale, who frowned back. Reynard, I said. It's amazing how fast you can cross London in a vintage Jag if you put on blues and twos and your governor drives like a maniac. Although there's still nothing to be done about the gridlock on Vauxhall Bridge in the evening, except invest in a Sherman tank. We'd called ahead to Belgravia to tell the custody sergeant to put the custody suite on lockdown, and I mentally added Falcon lockdown procedures to the ever-growing consultation document. I had the Jag's airwave set to Belgravia's channel, and Nightingale drove in silence through the grey drizzle as we listened out for screams and lamentations.
But these didn't start until we arrived back to find half a busy Monday night's customers piling up in the corridor, and the shift duty inspector waiting for us with a dangerous gleam in his eye and a metaphorical rolling pin in his hand. After him was the custody sergeant, who pointed out that her duty of care extended to all the prisoners in her cells, thank you. She'd heard rumors of collapsing houses, burning markets, and what really happened at the Savile Row, Nick, a couple of years back. She wanted a pretty comprehensive risk assessment, or, failing that, we could take our suspect somewhere else, thank you very much. We couldn't take Reynard to the Folly, because never mind that we weren't PACE compliant, we didn't even have any cells, although I suppose we could have put him in one of the disused servants' rooms in the attic. The custody sergeant suggested that Paddington Green, it being where we lock up the terrorist suspects, would be a more suitable location. But Nightingale didn't agree.
A prisoner's always most vulnerable when he's being moved, he said. And in any case, if our adversary was truly planning an attack, I believe he would have done it by now.
But I noticed he arranged to spend the shift in the custody suite, which meant I got sent off to fetch refs, make a formal note of our actions, and catch up on paperwork. David Carey asked if I wanted to go to the pub to celebrate his successful raid, which had netted 2 butcher's knives, a bag of slightly doubtful skunk, and, the reason for the celebration, 3,000 quid in used readies that had intent to supply written all over them. Beverly was babysitting her sister Brent that evening, so a bit of moderate police boozing seemed appropriate. Right up until FBI agent Kim Reynolds rang me on her disposable pay-as-you-go. I thought I'd finally take you up on that kebab, she said. It actually took me a couple of seconds to process that, to remember Shepherd's Bush Market in the snow, Zach having the snot knocked out of him, and me knocking Kimberly down with Impello because I thought she was reaching for a gun. Then we'd gone round the corner for a kebab, or at least I did. Kimberly had stuck to Coca-Cola despite the fact that the coffee hadn't actually been that bad. There's always time for a cheeky kebab, I said. When are you going to be hungry?
About an hour, she said.
Kebab it is then, I said, and then popped down to tell Nightingale where I was going. The Uxbridge Road was full of hunched figures hurrying for the tube station as I found a rare parking space down a side street and hunched my own way through the irritatingly persistent rain to the other side of the bridge. It was a classic Kurdish kebab place in that it looked exactly like the Greek kebab places I'd grown up with, only now the meat was guaranteed halal. Just to shake things up, Kimberly had gone for the coffee while I, as a mark of respect to the late Aidan Burley, had a falafel. Kimberly had eschewed the mandated FBI agent in a suit look for a pair of off-duty black jeans, an orange and grey sweatshirt with OSU embossed across the front, a blue quilted jacket, and, as far as I could tell, no shoulder holster.
You stopped dyeing your hair, I said.
Since I was already knee-deep in the X-Files, I gave up trying to hide the color, she said.
So the X-Files are real?
You'd love that, wouldn't you? But I'm sorry to disappoint you, she said.
What, no UFOs?
Not yet, said Kimberly, and sipped her coffee with every sign of pleasure. I'll be sure to let you know if they turn up.
I asked what had dragged her back across the pond. She waved her hand around at the worn formica and easy clean plastic interior of the kebab shop.
This is all your fault, she said.
I really don't think it is, I said.
Kimberly begged to differ.
After our little adventures underground, I was curious, she said. It didn't seem likely that you Brits had a monopoly on...
She hesitated.
Magic? It seemed unlikely, she shrugged. That's the trouble with being law enforcement. You can't let things go.
So she dug around and was probably not as subtle as she thought she was, because the next thing she knew, she was sitting in her supervisor's office with a deputy assistant director who'd flown in specially from Washington that very morning just to have a conversation with her.
He had my London file open on the desk and looked me in the eye and said, "Do you have anything else to add to this report?" And I said I may have, but I wasn't sure he was going to like it.
She grinned.
I'm paraphrasing here, you understand. He said, Why don't you just tell me, and I'll be the judge of that. So what did you tell him?
Well, I started out small, just testing the waters. A little bit about how you seem to be able to do some things I wasn't sure I could explain. He just nodded at me and asked if I'd encountered other instances of magic during my investigation.
And?
I told him everything about you, Nightingale, Leslie, the Folly, even the people living under the city. Didn't seem to faze him at all.
She was offered a transfer to Washington within a week.
I say offered,
said Kimberling.
It was more ordered.
To the Office of Partner Engagement, which handles cooperation between the FBI, partner agencies, and local law enforcement. So is that where they keep the X-Files?
Yeah.
She leaned back on her chair.
There's a big secret warehouse.
Mostly, she worked a regular shift engaging with the FBI's partners.
Whether they wanted to be engaged with or not, she said.
The weird shit she was supposed to deal with in her spare time.
Like what? They've had me looking into the possibility of demonic possession of active shooters, she said.
Active shooters, being individuals who arm themselves, and then pop out and kill as many innocent bystanders as possible. There had been a definite upward trend in both incidents and casualty rates since the turn of the century. And since gun control was off the table, the FBI had been looking for other preventative measures. Kimberly had actually found literature on the subject from, of all places, the Centers for Disease Control. They'd commissioned a 1995 study that hinted very obliquely that some incidents of mass murder could not be solely attributed to normal criminality or psychological conditions. The study had never been officially released, and no follow-up had ever been authorized. So Kimberly had gone on a road trip around the US interviewing all the surviving gunmen that would talk to her. I thought of Mr. Punch and the trail of bloody mayhem he'd left behind him, and asked if she had any confirmed cases.
That's hard to say,
said Kimberly.
Half the time the shooter kills himself or is shot dead by first responders. And the rest all have their own sad stories.
They'd been abused or victimized, or they just plain didn't like the way the world had treated them and had decided to teach it a lesson. But there had been one interview Kimberly had conducted in Florence, Arizona. A 36-year-old white male who'd inexplicably woken up one morning, shot his wife, and then driven over to his mother-in-law's house to shoot her too, and only missed making the FBI's list of mass killers because he'd been tackled by the postman before he could open up at the local 7-Eleven. He claimed during his interview with Kimberly that he'd been possessed by the spirit of a bear.
An old bear, he said. From a time before the arrival of the white man, an angry old bear, said Kimberly.
I asked if she believed him.
Have you ever heard a bear?
She asked.
One that's really angry? Nothing else sounds like a bear. It's got that kind of deep, breathy bark. Let's just say I've heard it twice. Once, when I was out hunting with my dad, and again, when I was talking to the shooter in Florence.
She paused, to see how I was taking it, I think, before continuing.
Not literally, but like an echo or... I'm not sure.
A memory, I said, and Kimberly gave me a hard look.
You do know what I'm talking about,
she said.
Don't you?
It's called vestigia, I said. It's sort of like, an afterglow from magic. Although, to be honest, sometimes it's just stuff you make up in your head, or even a memory triggered by an association with something somebody says or does.
So is it real or not?
Said Kimberly. I told her it was real, but learning to differentiate the real from the unreal was one of the things you needed a teacher for, although an annoying dog can be of some help. When she asked what breed of dog I recommended, I realized I might have been leading her a bit astray.
Forget about the dog,
I said.
I like the dog,
said Kimberly.
The dog is a distraction, I said.
Kimberly's lips twitched.
You don't say,
she said.
So do you think my active shooter was possessed or not?
He might have been, I said. But that doesn't mean that whatever got into his head made him kill those people. It might have wanted something else, but your shooter misinterpreted it, or it might have been influenced by the shooter's personality. And even if it unequivocally did influence him to shoot his wife,